If you have your Bibles, I invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 13. A couple weeks ago, we started a short series that will go through Easter about the life of Abram. And he starts out as Abram and later becomes Abraham, as we talked about in a couple weeks ago. And as we've looked at one episode in Abram's life, it's important to realize that when we look at the characters of faith in the Bible, that they're not there to be put on a pedestal so that we think how great they are, but so that we see God at work in their lives. And so I remind you that that I'm encouraging you over these weeks to be looking for God sightings in your life. And I don't know if in the last 2 weeks you've had any good God sightings, but I hope if you have, you've shared them with your family or a small group or with a friend, because really, that's what we're looking for in the life of Abram, are some sightings of what God was doing in his life, and what God did in Abram's life, he's also doing in our lives as well. And so I trust that this will be a great time as we head into Easter to see God working in your life. Before we look at this passage, let's bow before God again. Lord God, we thank you for who you are. We thank you that despite the fact that so often we make ourselves the center of our lives and the center of our universe, that is who you are. We thank you for a service like this one to be reminded of who you are and to reflect on whose we are. Father, I pray that in these moments ahead that you would help us to see you, to learn about you, and to grow in our relationship with you. I pray for each person who is here today. There are some people who are facing some major crises in their lives, relationship conflicts, financial concerns, job issues, family crises, health issues. These are just some of the things that I'm aware of, and each of us comes before you with our own needs. Lord, I pray that we would be able to face the needs that we have in our lives and see your hand involved in our lives and know how to respond because of what your word tells us this day. So we commit these moments ahead to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, a couple weeks ago when we started looking at the life of Abram, I mentioned that all of us are in one of three places. You're either coming out of a crisis, soon to go into a crisis, or in the middle of a crisis. And we find every time we pick up the story of Abram that that's kind of what's happening in his life. So it's a good reminder who he is of who we are. And as Abram has to sort out who he is and what he believes in the midst of his crises, I hope that today as we look at what he has to face, that you'll be able to think about what is the bedrock in your life when everything else kind of goes crazy, when you're just ready to give up. What is it that you can hang on to and really cling to? When we last met Abram, he was leaving Egypt. If you remember the story, he'd been there with Pharaoh, and we saw a side of Abram that was very human, a very cowardly side. He headed into Egypt with his beautiful wife at his side, and he knew that she would be someone who would be attractive to Pharaoh. And so he told a little lie. He told Pharaoh that his wife was his sister. And actually, it's a pretty big lie, but it was a little lie because there was some truth to it, as we saw to it. Anyway, when Pharaoh found out about it, interestingly enough, instead of having Abram executed or whatever else, because he knew God's hand was with Abram because of the plagues that he had experienced, he sent Abram out of the country. And it's interesting, as Abram leaves the end of chapter 12, having really not been too faithful to God, God's blessing is on him despite himself. And I think most of us can attest that we have experienced that as well in our lives. That God blesses us often when we're obedient to him, but sometimes he blesses us in spite of our disobedience. And that's what happened with Abram. God made a promise to Abram, and he's going to renew that promise again and again in the coming chapters. But as it happens, Abram leaves Egypt apparently with more stuff, more servants, more flocks than he had when he headed into the land. But that leads to another problem. Because as Abram and his nephew Lot and Sarah and all of their servants head out of Egypt and they go back to the land, where they end up in the southern part of the land, there's not space for everybody. In fact, it's kind of interesting, just in passing, that if you read through chapter 12 and you read the story that we looked at a couple weeks ago of Abram with Sarah in Egypt, it sounds like it's just the story of Abram and his wife and Pharaoh. It's almost like if you're watching a movie, the photographer zooms in on Abram and Sarah and leaves everybody else out of the picture. Apparently, Lot was with them all along because he accompanies them out of Egypt, so we have to assume he was there with them in Egypt. But my assumption is that in chapter 12, the author is trying to help us see this personal crisis that Abram faced and how he dealt with it personally. And now, as the camera angle zooms out, you see that Abram is there with all of his servants and all of his herds, and there alongside him is Lot with all of his servants and all of his herds. And both groups of people have grown considerably. And now they're out in an area that just can't support all the flocks. There's just too many of them for the land that's available. And that's the first crisis. Because of the shortage of resources, Abram's servants and Lot's servants begin to fight with each other and quarrel about, you know, who has the right to this land and who has the right to this watering hole. And it doesn't take very long before word gets back to Abram and to Lot, we have a problem. There's just too many of us and not enough land on this ranch. So Abram proposes a solution. And it's interesting when you think about it. Abram just says, Lot, you choose. You decide which land you want, and you take it, and I'll take what's left over. And so Abram gives Lot the choice. And in chapter 10, or verse 10 of chapter 13, it says, Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was watered like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company, and Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. So at the time, Lot gets his choice, and he looks out, and at this particular point in the history of the land, this area that today is so barren, it is the wasteland around the Dead Sea, was apparently a very productive farming area. And so as Lot looked out, he said, I want that area, and I'm going to take it. Now, there's an awful lot that the narrator, the author, doesn't tell us as we read this story. We don't know for sure if Lot knew the wickedness of the city of Sodom. We know it. We've read the story. But he doesn't tell us whether Lot knew it. But one thing that struck me as I thought about it is that whether or not we know when we get into hanging out with the wrong crowd or doing the wrong things, when we surround ourselves with wicked people and evil influences, it's going to have a drastic effect on our lives. So whether Lot chose this area because he was in rebellion against God, we can't say. But we can say that because Lot chose to go where he went and because of the evil influences around him, he ended up in a very dangerous position. But one of my questions as I read through this is, why would Abram allow Lot to choose where he would go? I mean, Lot is Abram's nephew. Abram's the guy in charge. He should have the right. Lot had accompanied him. It really was his choice as to where he would live. So why did Abram allow Lot to choose? Well, the author doesn't tell us directly, but I think in many ways indirectly, he tells us that Abram was confident in God's hand. God was the one who had directed him to go to this land. He was the one who promised him the land, promised him that he'd be a blessing and that he'd have plenty of children. I think Abram's thinking was, if this is what God's directed, if God's in control, and I can afford to be generous. And I found that rather encouraging to me when it comes to how we live our lives. So often I live my life aware of the money I earn with my paycheck and all that I have provided for myself. On occasion, I realize that I've experienced many blessings in my life. My job, my income, my health. And these are gifts from a good God. And if God has given me all these good things, then I can afford to be generous. When needs come up, it's a part of faith in the God who's been good to me that I might be good and be able to provide for someone else. So Abram had some sense that God was in charge, and God had provided. And so I think because of that, he thought, if I let Lot choose, God's going to watch out for me. And sure enough, after Lot chooses and he moves out to the region that we know of as the Dead Sea area, Abram settles in back in between Bethel and Ai. And that's where God basically tells him again, you're my man. I've got a plan for you. He says, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south and east and west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring would be counted. Go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So Abram moved his tents and went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he built an altar to the Lord. Just in passing, it's interesting that in verse 10, Lot looked up and he looked around and he chose the land he wanted. When Abram committed himself to God, God tells Abram, look up, look at all the land. And basically, God gives Abram the same opportunity that Abram gave Lot. In other words, when Abram trusted his well-being to God, God said, this is all going to be yours. I'm going to provide for you. And that's something I think we need to be reminded of as God's people. We get into these situations in our lives when we just don't know how we're going to make it. We back ourselves into some sort of corner and we think that we have to cut corners morally or ethically to try to get ourselves out of a hole. But God showed Abram that when he put God first, God took care of everything else. And each of us needs to have enough knowledge of what God did in Abram's life that when those times come up in our lives and we're tempted to make it on our own ingenuity, to do it on our own, to have our own plan, to realize that if we just trust God, He'll give us what we need. Well, things looked like they were settling down. Abram had moved into his new home in Hebron, and Lot was now living out east. And it's now been a few years that have gone by. As far as we can tell, it's been about 14 years. And Abram hasn't heard much from Lot. And suddenly, a man comes staggering up to Abram's house. And he says, "Abram, there's a problem. A problem with your nephew Lot." And so, in the next chapter, we discover that there has been upheaval over in the land where Abram lives, or where Lot lives. And without going through all the details, the first 12 verses of the chapter basically tell about a man by the name of Chedorlaomer, who was a powerful king. And this king came in and he subjugated all the kings in the region, including the city of Sodom where Lot lived, and Gomorrah, and a couple other places. And Chedorlaomer got these kings in line. He overpowered them. And so they basically followed him for about 13 years. And finally they just got tired of being under Chedorlaomer's thumb. And so they made an alliance with themselves and they decided, "We're going to fight back and we're going to overthrow this Chedorlaomer." And so they instigate a fight. But they're not strong enough to overthrow this guy. Instead, Chedorlaomer comes in with his allies. There are three other kings. And they, instead of just subjugating them, they ransack the cities apparently. And they begin to take people back into captivity. And this man who comes to Abram to tell him what's going on in verse 13 basically explains those details. And it says in verse 13, "And one who escaped came and reported this to Abram, the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre, the Amorite, a brother of Eshtol and Aner, all of whom were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan." Now, when you think about it, you wonder, was this a good idea for Abram to go after this man, this king, Chedorlaomer? I mean, he is powerful enough that twice he has overthrown these kings and their city-states over by Sodom and Gomorrah. And now he's overthrown them once again. And as this man comes back from the battle, he says, "Look, what's happened is Chedorlaomer has taken people away. There the whole area was full of tar pits, and some of the people had escaped. Some people had jumped into the tar pits to hide. But he said it's a sad state of affairs, and Lot's been taken away." We get a sense of how much Abram's household and all of his property has grown, that he has not just 318 servants, but 318 trained men, soldiers, mercenaries, who can do battle. This is the only place, by the way, where this word "trained men" occurs, but outside of the Bible, it occurs at least one other place that has been found, and really it basically means these are people who are trained for battle. But how can 318 men have a chance against a king and his allies? Well, you can read through the passage for yourself, but we discover Abram allied himself with some other people, so there apparently were a few more than the 318. And they had a battle plan that was a plan that worked frequently in the Old Testament. A divide and conquer battle plan. And so he split up his forces and apparently had some sort of surprise attack. And as best we can tell, I don't think we know this for sure, but it seems that Chedorlaomer and his forces were now kind of, they'd already done all the damage they were going to do, so they were now retreating. And they weren't really expecting to be attacked. They had been victorious, but that's when Abram and his forces attacked. And they not only surprised Chedorlaomer, they rout his forces. And Abram frees Lot and all the captives that had been taken by Chedorlaomer. It's a pretty amazing story when you think about it, that this little nomad by the name of Abram has grown to this point, and that he's able to get a force together that can fight off a king. How is he able to do that? What is it that gives Abram the power? Now, it may be like we are. We oftentimes get into tough straits, and we try to figure out what we're going to do, and we come up with a plan, whether it's a plan for the church or a plan for our families or a plan for our businesses. And we see some amazing things happen. And we may be tempted to pat ourselves on the back with how ingenious we are, how hardworking we are. At least in Abram's case, while he had trained men and he certainly went after these people, it's apparent that the bottom line, God was with Abram. And that's why he was successful. God had helped rout these forces, and it was all part of God's blessing upon Abram. And like us, I think Abram needed to be aware that it wasn't just his own strength. It was God's hand fighting for him. We'll see that as we go along. Well, as Abram comes back from the battle, he has an encounter with two kings from the region. One is the king of Sodom, and the other is a king by the name of Melchizedek. It says in verse 10, "Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High and blessed Abram, saying, 'Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of the heavens and the earth. Blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand.'" Melchizedek stands as one who recognized that God had fought for Abram. And that's how Abram had been successful. And Abram, in response to Melchizedek, gave him a tenth of everything that he had taken, all of the spoils from the battle. Then the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord Most High, creator of the heaven and the earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing from what my men have eaten and share what that and the share that belongs to the men who went with me. Let them have their share." So Abram meets these two kings, and there's really a lot of mystery to this encounter. We know nothing about this one king, Melchizedek. In fact, even his name is a little bit of a mystery, because it means either Melech, which is king, of Tzedek, righteousness, the king of righteousness, or it means his name is Melech, who is righteous, or the king is righteous. We don't know what his name is really made up of, a compound of king and righteous. And so he's kind of a mysterious figure. In fact, because he's a mysterious figure, the writer of Hebrews later on picks up what happens here, and some of the traditions and some of the thoughts about where this man originated from, that because it's not spelled out. And he builds a whole case in the book of Hebrews to show that Jesus is a priest who's more like this Melchizedek, who just shows up out of nowhere and blesses Abram. But that's for a study in Hebrews, but we just don't know much about this guy, except that when he shows up, it's clear from what he says that the one who's victorious was victorious because God had fought for him. And Abram gives him a tenth of what he has, seemingly to recognize that he is a king and maybe even seeing him as something of a priest. Now, one other thing that's just worth noting, and probably important to note, when you think about Abram, it's very easy to assume that Abram has this relationship with God the way we have a relationship with God. That Abram has spent a lifetime in Bible study, and he knows the Bible backwards and forwards and has a clear understanding of who God is. But if we just recognize that this is just the beginning of the book of Genesis, and not much has been revealed to people about God. In fact, Abram's story begins at the end of chapter 11, so there's just been 11 chapters about God. That's all the information that Abram would know. His knowledge of God is really pretty slim. We don't even know for sure that Abram became a God follower without having some pagan gods on the side. I mean, all we know is that he's in this process, and we see him in each of these stages getting a clear understanding of who God is. And that's really what this story is all about for us. It is, as we learn Abram's story and as we learn about this covenant that God makes with him, it's really a way for us to learn more about God and see how God relates to Abram, how he relates to people. And I think as time goes on, Abram begins to recognize that there is one God. But this Melchizedek, if he was just a pagan king, when he spoke of God Most High, he probably wasn't talking about the God that we identify as our God. He was probably talking about some pagan deity. But later on, Abram recognizes that this God Most High is Yahweh, his God. And that's the one who's delivered him. So, Abram has been able to fight off Chedorlaomer. The crisis seems to have been averted, and things look like they're getting back on the right track, but there's still one problem that Abram has. God has promised Abram a blessing. Remember, the covenant we said has three parts to it. There's the promise of the land that God was given to Abram. There's the promise that his offspring, his seed, would be as numerous as the sand of the sea or the stars of the sky, and that he would be a blessing to the whole earth. And even the Melchizedek's blessing in verse 19, indicates that God is already doing that. It says, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of the heaven and earth. Blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." So already God is showing his blessing. Abram has flocks and servants. He's been promised the land. He really hasn't fully taken possession of it yet, but he's at least living in part of it. But Abram realizes that there's a big part that is missing in his life. And that is that God has promised that he would have offspring. And there's no indication that that's going to happen. So in chapter 15, it says, "After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I think he tells him not to be afraid because of this vision. I am your shield, your very great reward. I think it's just another way of saying, Abram, I'm the one who has fought for you. I'm the one that's brought you this far. I'm the one that's made you successful. But Abram said, Oh, sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. Abram, as we will see in the subsequent chapters, is very concerned. God has made this promise to him, but he's getting old. And he's getting past the age where he should be expecting to have kids. And so he said, God, I see you're delivering on some of these promises, but I don't have an heir. Maybe it's supposed to be this servant, Eliezer. But it says in verse 4, Then the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, Look up in the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to them, So will your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. That verse is one of the foundation stones of the Old and New Testament, about someone who was told what God had promised and just staked his life on that promise. And it seems to me that that's the major thing that Abram has to learn in this encounter, and it's a major thing he has to learn throughout his life. And that is, he simply had to trust God and believe in what he knew that God had revealed of himself. And if he did that, God would take care of everything else. And so, as Abram commits himself to believe what God has revealed, God promises that he will do what he's promised. And it's interesting that after Abram has committed himself, the very next verse, it seems like he's questioning what he's just committed. He says, "And also, he also said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land and take possession of it. But Abram said, Oh, sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? So the Lord said to him, Bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. Abram brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite them. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. And then the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick, dreadful darkness came over him. And the Lord said to him, Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot and a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. This is apparently a vision of God that takes place in the darkness. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, To your descendants I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Cadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. I suppose Abram was worried about the land, because he knew that he would live to see a descendant if that was going to come from his own body. Then he began to think, but what about the land? Am I going to get this land? And it's interesting that in God's promise, basically what he says is, Abram, I am going to give you this land in 400 years. Can you imagine moving? You're living in an apartment, and God says, "I've got a place for you to live. It's a house over here, and you move over to the house and you begin to rent it. And you say, you know, God, when am I going to actually take ownership of this? And God says, it'll be 400 years. In fact, you're not going to actually take ownership of it. It'll be your offspring. That's really what God promised to Abram. And yet, Abram was beginning to learn that he could trust God for what God revealed of himself to Abram. When you stop to think about it, each of us, we may look at Abram and think that he had so much going for him, but he knew so much less about God than you and I know. God, in the course of about 100 years in Abram's life, God spoke to Abram maybe 6 or 8 times. We have a revelation that we can pick up every day that tells us about God in far more detail than Abram ever got. And God, the God who spoke to Abram, said, I'll be your shield. I'll take care of you. Is our God as well. In fact, it's interesting that it was out of Egypt when God was delivering his people that he instituted this Passover meal. A meal that was a reminder that God's hand was involved in the deliverance of his people. And when we come to the Lord's table, really we have the opportunity not only to just take God at his word, but also to look back on all of history and to see how God has been faithful to his people throughout history. Not just Abram, but Moses and David. Consistently, God has been working out his plan. And when we face those times in our lives where we begin to wonder, God simply says, you got to believe what I've told you about myself. If you trust that, your life will be all right. That's how your spiritual life begins. When you recognize that you can't please God on your own, all your best efforts don't make it, when you realize that God has revealed that he has sent his son for you to pay the price that your goodness and your hard work can't achieve. But if you believe that he has done everything and just take him at his word, then it is credited to you as righteousness, just as it was for Abraham. And when you face the challenges and the crises of your life and you think, I don't know if I can trust God or not, just remember, we have all of history to look back on and see God's faithfulness to his people. And a promise that hasn't even been completed yet, because this also reminds us that although God has been faithful to this point, he promises the fulfillment of all of his plan. And so as we come to this table today, this is our opportunity to recognize who God is, to trust him in faith, and to let him change our lives. Would you bow with me as we give thanks?